Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, January 15th, 2016. Holy cow, I'm supposed to pay my estimated taxes today. And I just remembered when I said the date. All right, Uncle Sam, Sacramento, I'll pay up, I promise. Last night, there was another Republican debate.
Presidential elections are planned distractions to divert attention from the action behind the scenes.
Oh, there was plenty of distraction.
Like a game of chess when the house is a mess.
Lots of demagoguery.
Or a petty money squabble when your marriage is in trouble. Or a football game when there's rioting in the streets.
Well, Donald Trump has set a very low bar for performance by presidential candidates this year, and his other candidates, the competitors, really lowered themselves to his level in another debate that came from South Carolina on the Fox Business Channel last night. And once again, the tone and the way these debates are managed is like a game show, like a wrestling match. The audience was permitted to hoot and holler and boo and hiss. And the moderators fed red meat to the candidates to provoke those kinds of responses. And like a game show or American Idol, they say that because Trump is number one in the polls, he gets the center stage position. And once again, they don't ask the same question to all the candidates so that you can compare and contrast. It's just a series of pokes and jabs and gotchas to see what candidates will say. And Ted Cruz, who is surging, so to speak, in the Republican primary polls, he was the target as the, you know, presumed front runner, or tying with Trump as front runner in some of the polls. And so he was the center of attention, and he really showed himself to be an ugly person, not talking about his face. But he's a man who can brag about his desire to carpet bomb innocent civilians in order to wipe out the Islamic State. And he really is unselfconscious about the deranged persona that he presents. And sure, he's a good slash-and-burn debater, but he really exposed himself as a man who would be very dangerous should he become president of the United States. And I don't think I've told you about this yet, but you may know last September I took 3 weeks off. We went to Spain. We met some friends there and shared a place. And one of the things we did there was a little presidential pool. And I was the only one out of this group who chose on a 3 euro bet that Bernie Sanders would be the Democratic nominee and Ted Cruz would be the Republican nominee. And I may be right about that. I'm not cashing. I'm not going to spend that money in advance. But Cruz has really surfaced as the guy who can really package the anger, the unfocused emotion, and the attention deficit persona that Donald Trump presents. And so too many of these Republicans who are really down in the gutter this year, a gutter fighter like Ted Cruz, fits the bill for them. So it was really bizarre. I was screaming multiple times at the TV because particularly when these guys, and it was all guys last night, talk about what they'll do about the Islamic State, what kind of war they'll wage in the Middle East. They just offer a lot of bluster and a whole lot of testosterone, trying to outdo each the others who came before him. And the most surprising pattern was all of these attacks on President Obama. And you know, I'm a sharp critic of Obama. I see a lot of things wrong with the way he has operated as president. But these were these just meaningless attacks, swipes that are based on Frank Luntz commentary that was dredged out of focus groups of hardline Republican primary voters. And so it just made me queasy to watch this parade of idiocy, this unfocused anger at Washington, at New York, at Obama. And it was interesting because Ted Cruz, for whatever reason, was asked the first question, and he dodged the question for most of the allotted time so he could launch into a rehearsed and scripted attack on President Obama over the brief detention of two gunboats in the Persian Gulf that occurred on the day of the State of the Union message. And Cruz used the images. We saw the sailors who were required to kneel on the cockpit, on the deck of the boat, with their hands behind their heads. And if we took any Iranian sailors into custody under similar circumstances, that's exactly what we would do. And so Cruz, you know, plays this up, exaggerates it as this huge humiliation to the United States. And the Defense Department has now conceded, yeah, our riverboats, these gunboats, drifted off into Iranian waters. They're saying it was accidental. I'm willing to accept that, although I'm always skeptical about these things. And if you just think back a month or so, President Obama embraced Turkey's response to Russia's 17-second violation of Turkish airspace and shot down a Russian fighter. The United States said that was okay. But when we acknowledge that our sailors crossed over into Iranian waters and then they admitted it, they apologized for it, and that is seen as some sort of weakness that has to be played out by these blustery bullshit Republicans who offer no details whatsoever of how they would achieve these far-fetched goals that they articulate. And it was interesting to see them just, you know, as if they're running for demagogue-in-chief. Who can say the most outrageous and outraged thing? And that's what voters are supposed to respond to? It is really strange. And you've got them, you know, trading half-truths. Marco Rubio is now on the attack against, Chris Christie. Now, who cares about either one of those two? you know, in terms of being real contenders. And because apparently Chris Christie made a contribution to Planned Parenthood 20 years ago, one of Rubio's researchers dug that out and smacked Christie with it on the stage last night. And they also try to make it seem like Chris Christie is in Obama's pocket, so Christie has to call Obama a petulant child for his use of executive orders when the Republican Congress would not move any legislation on immigration or other issues where Obama took action. Now, one of the other interesting exchanges was when Trump hammered Ted Cruz for running a TV commercial in Iowa, which paints Donald Trump with New York values. And those are dog whistle code words that are supposed to work in Iowa because New York is full of hateful, loathsome individuals, right? But in the New York Times today, Jim Dwyer points out that Cruz gets a whole lot of his campaign cash from New York City. He was there for a million-dollar fundraiser in December, and a guy named Robert Mercer, a computer scientist and hedge fund guru, has kicked in $11 million to Ted Cruz's campaign. And let's not forget the allegations that surfaced and were quickly dismissed last night about Ted Cruz. His wife works for Goldman Sachs. They got a $500,000 loan from Goldman Sachs that they didn't report that was used in the Senate campaign in Texas that got Ted Cruz where he is today. There was no mention of the $1.1 million in total, including another loan, I think from Citibank. And Cruz was allowed to dismiss the birther issues by attacking the New York Times for reporting on these matters, on the loans and on the honest questions about whether he is qualified to be president. And the hypocrisy is just so rampant and rich. And then Trump hammers Cruz because of the damage he may do to the Republican Party, because Democrats are likely to sue over Cruz's qualification to be president. So I had to go soak in the tub for quite a while after I survived that debate last night. And it just does not bode well for the future of our country. Because nothing useful came out of these debates. It's all heat, no light. Nothing that leads you to believe that any one of those people would make a good president of the United States. And it is their cross attacks and just the whole disarray that the Republican establishment finds itself in this year that encourages me that Bernie Sanders could win if the Democrats allow him to get the nomination this year. We'll come back to Sanders and Clinton in a moment. I learned today that Justin Amash, the conservative Republican congressman from Michigan, has introduced legislation to repeal the elements of the Cromnibus, that's the budget omnibus bill that was jammed through at the end of 2015. And he wants to repeal the language that comprised a bill that was alive before that called CISA, the Cyber Information Sharing Act. And I wish there were a Democrat or a progressive of any stripe who was stepping up to take on this important constitutional issue. But the leadership is coming from a conservative Republican, and I applaud it. Amash says that CISA allows unconstitutional, warrantless surveillance of law-abiding Americans. The law grants immunity from liability to companies that share employees' or users' private information with the government or other companies, as long as they do so under the guise of cybersecurity. It places no limits on the type of information that can be shared, which could include individuals' personal online communications. And it allows the government to use the information it receives for purposes unrelated to cybersecurity, including the investigation and prosecution of unrelated crimes. Yes, that in three paragraphs is a good description of the really, really ugly and unconstitutional language in this bill. The White House wanted it. Many Republicans wanted it. Too many Democrats wanted it, and it was rammed into the bill, and everybody just kind of held their noses and let it go. So, to his credit, Amash has bipartisan co-sponsors, including Conyers of Michigan, Lofgren of California, Massey, a Republican colleague, also a conservative in the so-called Freedom Caucus from Kentucky, and a couple of others. While we're on the surveillance front yesterday, I mentioned that Britain has been embracing the Stingray technology. These are the cell site simulators that operate from a briefcase-sized box, causing every cell phone in the area to check in and dump its information. And it's intended to be used in investigations where they're targeting specific suspects, but it sweeps up the data of thousands of innocent people who just happen to be nearby. Well, today, The Verge, an online publication, has published an excellent piece that details the history of Stingray and how a convicted criminal who was trying to understand how he got caught ran down the origins of Stingray and its deployment in U.S. law enforcement agencies. It's a fascinating piece. I will link to it in the show file for this podcast, and I encourage you to take a look at it. Yesterday, I also reported about how Canada, without using Stingray technology, has seen a struggle between the government of Ottawa, that's one of the provinces of Canada, and two cell phone carriers who are resisting sweeping warrants for information on large numbers of their customers linked to an investigation of jewelry store robberies. The phone companies say that the warrant asked for 43,000 records on cell phone users, and that was determined to be unconstitutional by a Canadian judge. And I noted that some of the really bad developments in American law enforcement since 9/11, the creeping police state, have infected Britain and Canada as well. And here is another example. In British Columbia, that's Vancouver, the west coast of Canada, a man convicted of plotting to bomb the province's legislature may have been radicalized by someone from Canada's spy agency, according to newly released court documents. The convict is a man named John Nuttall and his girlfriend Amanda Corady. They were converts to Islam, and they were found guilty last June of possessing explosive devices for a terrorist group and conspiring to commit murder back in 2013. They pled not guilty, but their convictions were won through undercover tape recordings. And their lawyers now argue that the couple was entrapped by undercover police officers during a lengthy sting operation. Much of the evidence against them came from 70 hours of surveillance footage. Now, if the entrapment argument is successful, their convictions could be overturned. Now, I have to say that in the United States, it's very difficult to prove entrapment, and we see it used time and time again by the FBI and the so-called Justice Department to win these so-called domestic terrorism convictions. And I recently have reported to you on the San Francisco prosecution based on a sting operation, paid informants, $1 million dropped, of Raymond Shrimp Boy Chow. Now, on his appeals, I'm sure that attorney Tony Serra is going to raise the entrapment issue, but it's very difficult to prove under American law. So after their trial last year, the attorney told reporters that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had manufactured her client's crimes. And we've heard that quite frequently here in the United States. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscription dollars. People like James Hallwell, who just returned to the fold here, took out an annual subscription. Thank you, James. Carla Mahoney is a monthly subscriber, as is Linda Lewis and Jason Ferguson. So I'd like you to join them. Just take a couple of minutes to come over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu tab in the upper right-hand corner, then you click on Become a Subscriber. There you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, our $50 annual subscription. Don't forget the Spreaker app that allows Android users to easily access our podcasts, or the iPhone iPad app that is available for $2.99 in the App Store at Apple. Earlier this week, I released a conversation with Jason Leopold, and we talked about Hillary Clinton's emails and the San Bernardino shootout on December 2nd. But he was on deadline, and I had to end the interview before I got to a couple of other items. And today, at Vice News, and I'm linking to his story, he's written an update on the case of Sabrina de Souza. She is an American and Portuguese dual citizen. She worked for the CIA for more than 10 years, and she is accused by the Italian prosecutor of being the mastermind of the 2003 CIA kidnapping and rendition of Abu Omar in broad daylight from the streets of Milan. It was a bungled caper and led to the conviction of de Souza and 25 other Americans in absentia in Italian courts. So, as you may know, we reported last fall that de Souza went to Portugal, where she was served with an extradition warrant from Italy. And today, a judge has ruled, and it's not fully binding until it's appealed to the Supreme Court in Portugal, but a judge has ruled that she must be extradited to Italy. And I find it interesting that Armando Spataro, the Italian prosecutor, calls her the mastermind. I have never seen her painted in that role, and I'm really curious how he comes up with that description. She certainly was involved, but she has an alibi that she was skiing in, I think, Switzerland with her son on the day of the kidnapping. But that may have just been some sort of a cover story. At any rate, de Souza has been trying to get the CIA to defend her using her diplomatic immunity. She was using a State Department cover for her assignment in Milan. And she also has been trying to get the CIA to release internal documents that would show that she was not the mastermind of this bad caper. So this story goes on, and at some point it could produce new information that would be deeply embarrassing to the CIA. One event that did occur over the Christmas holidays, the president of Italy shaved 2 years off the sentence of the CIA chief, Robert Lady from Milan, who was involved in this caper, and they reduced his sentence from 9 years to 7. He also lost some property. He owned a villa in Italy that was taken after his conviction. Sean Penn will be on 60 Minutes Sunday night. It's going to be a busy night for TV viewing. There's a Democratic debate. There's an NFL playoff game. I think John Oliver is returning to the tube on HBO. So it's going to be a lot to see. Sean Penn, of course, is being interviewed about his effort to interview El Chapo, Joaquin Guzman, the Mexican drug lord. And there are a couple of interesting comments that have been pre-released from the Charlie Rose interview. "I have a terrible regret," Sean Penn said. "I have a regret that the entire discussion about this article ignores its purpose, which was to contribute to this conversation on the war on drugs." He added, "There's this myth about my visit, the visit my colleagues and I made to El Chapo, that it was essential to his capture. Well, we had met with him many weeks earlier on the 2nd of October in a place nowhere near where he was captured." And Penn, I read his 10,000-word piece, and it's true. His real goal was to really undermine the failure or expose the failure of the so-called war on drugs. He says, "Let's go to the big picture of what we all want. We all want this drug problem to stop. We want them, the killings in Chicago, to stop. We are the consumer. Whether you agree with Sean Penn or not, there is a complicity here. And if you're in the moral right or on the far left, just as many of your children are doing these drugs. And how much time have they spent in the last week since this article came out talking about that? 1% maybe?" He says that would be generous. Planned Parenthood has filed suit here in San Francisco federal court against the crew of people who made the deceptive films, the videos, of Planned Parenthood officers talking about, when they were deceptively edited, the videos made it seem like they were talking about profiting from the sale of body parts from aborted fetuses. And the defendants include the Center for Medical Progress, the videographer David Daleiden, and Troy Newman, the head of Operation Rescue, who is accused of helping to plan the elaborate deception. The lawsuit reads, or actually this is a statement from Planned Parenthood, "The people behind this fraud lied and broke the law in order to spread malicious lies about Planned Parenthood. We filed the case to hold them accountable." Meanwhile, the war on women continues. A judge in San Francisco has upheld the decision by Mercy Medical Center, a Catholic hospital north of San Francisco in the city of Redding, to deny a tubal ligation to a woman who gave birth to a child there and decided that's the last baby she wants to have. Judge Ernest Goldsmith said that Mercy Medical Center was not engaging in sex discrimination by denying Rebecca Chamorro the procedure of a tubal ligation because the hospital's policy against sterilization also applies to men. Now, this is bizarre, because this is not a gender-based issue. This is where the owners of a commercial hospital, a public hospital, are imposing their religious values on patients. Now, if a nun who is an executive at Mercy Medical Center doesn't want to have a procedure like this, no one is forcing her to do that. But this woman wants to make sure that she doesn't have more babies. It is her right to do so, and for a Catholic hospital to impose the Vatican's views is really un-American. It's not a secular decision, and it doesn't respect the separation of church and state. And this is all done by turning on its ear the concept of religious liberty. Religious liberty is the right to practice your faith, not to impose it on other people in a commercial setting. Goldman Sachs has agreed to pay $5 billion to settle claims that it misled mortgage bond investors during the Big Short of 2008. And this is another way that the Obama Justice Department has avoided investigating the individuals who presided over the outright fraud that we know occurred. At some point, the gaming of security-backed mortgages and the credit-default swaps that are also well explained in the movie The Big Short. It crossed the line, in my opinion, to criminal behavior. And yet Eric Holder and now Loretta Lynch refuse to indict a single individual for these white-collar crimes. And they'll allow shareholders of these companies to pay out billions of dollars, which is really limited satisfaction because it doesn't go to the people who lost their homes. The Goldman settlement is at the lower end of the batch here. Bank of America paid $16 billion. J.P. Morgan settled for $13 billion. And Goldman got off for $5 billion. They have friends in high places, you know. And among them are Hillary and Bill Clinton. Hillary Clinton made millions in speaking fees that went directly into her pockets from Wall Street banks, including Goldman Sachs. And Bernie Sanders put out a TV commercial. And as you know, Bernie has said he's not going to run a negative campaign and he's never run a negative spot, a TV spot. Well, I think that his unilateral disarmament is a mistake. But that's how he's chosen to run this campaign. And he, you know, when you run against a woman, it's difficult. You have to be very careful in how you criticize or attack. Well, what's really rich now, as is part of the underhanded attacks that the Clinton campaign has launched against Sanders this week because, well, he's caught up with Hillary and is beating her in New Hampshire. He may beat her in Iowa. And so they are going negative on Bernie. And one of the things they're doing is claiming that his Wall Street TV commercial is a negative ad. Now, this is classic Clinton, and the Clintons are using a rove strategy to attack Sanders on his strongest point of political identity. So this is a really fascinating exchange. And of course, it is so bogus. And I give Rachel Maddow credit on the MSDNC telecast last night. She interviewed Hillary Clinton and she asked her some tough questions and pushed her about the extent to which they are mischaracterizing Bernie Sanders' plans. And in particular, Chelsea launched this tirade in New Hampshire the other day, claiming that Sanders would gut Medicare and the CHIP program as he, gut Obamacare and the Children's Health Insurance Program as he moved us to single payer. And that's flatly untrue. And then they trotted out Howard Dean on television to back up the Hillary position. Howard Dean used to believe in single payer, but now that he's a lobbyist who gets money from pharma and other interested parties, he has joined the Clinton bandwagon. Now, all of this I find ugly and reprehensible. And Chris Hayes on MSNBC the other night gave Bernie Sanders the opportunity to call out the Clinton campaign. He asked Bernie if this attack from Chelsea was demagoguing the issue. And Bernie deflected the question. He will not use strong language. He will not call the lies of the Clinton campaign what they are, lies. And I think this could be a fatal flaw in the candidate and his campaign. He's got really one more chance in this debate on Sunday night that is scheduled so that nobody will see it. He's got to come up with a soundbite that is the one that plays after the debate, that people remember, and that distinguishes him from Clinton, and that paints her accurately as the dirty campaigner that she has proven to be once again this week. And finally today, the World Health Organization has announced officially that the Ebola scare is behind us, that the outbreak, the epidemic, is over. And I knew this day would come, even at the height of the hysteria, when American media networks and Chris Christie from New Jersey were in a hysterical reaction, acting as if we were all at risk for Ebola to infect us. And it was all just bullshit. It was the kind of injection of fear that politicians have become so adept at. That's part of the new normal in America today. Thanks for joining me for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you're free to share with absolutely everyone. Put it up on Facebook and share it with your friends. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you. again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling and